Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Give your walls the most advanced protection with Pittsburgh's Paramount Interior Paint and Primer in one. It's scuff, scrub, and wear resistant, while also blocking stains and delivering true one coat coverage. Choose from thousands of color options and refresh your space for spring. View our entire selection of paint and accessories today on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to find great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. It's your girl, Holly, and I am back today with another solved murder case for you all. I don't have any big case updates today other than the Corey Richens trial starts on February 23rd. The jury has been selected, and so the ball is rolling. As always, I plan to kind of keep up with what is happening with that, and I will let you guys know as the trial is going on. It's expected to last into, I think it said March 6th, so it's going to be a bit. Anyway, other than that, I don't have any other updates, so we are just going to jump right in. Today's episode is on the murder of Carrie Ann Jopek. Carrie Ann Jopek was born on August 17, 1968 to her parents Carol and Robert in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Not long after Carrie was born, her parents divorced and Carol later remarried a man named Fred, who stepped into the role as Carrie's stepfather. Carrie lived full-time with her mom, her stepfather, and her younger sister Maggie in Cudahy, which is a suburb south of Milwaukee tucked along the shore of Lake Michigan. There isn't a whole lot of information available about Carrie's early childhood, but by all accounts, she had a fairly normal upbringing. Her mother described her as beautiful, artistic, and a strong student. She was creative, bright, full of personality, and extremely strong-willed. Her friend Margie described her as outgoing, bubbly, funny, caring, smart, and someone who loved to sing. Carrie was also a lover of animals and had dreams of someday becoming a veterinarian. By 1982, Carrie was 13 years old and in the seventh grade, an age where most kids are just beginning to figure out who they are in life. Like many teenagers, Carrie sometimes pushed boundaries and challenged authority. She especially butted heads with her stepfather, but nothing about this seemed out of the ordinary. Most of us can probably relate. I know I had my moments as a teenager where I was told to do one thing and I did the exact opposite. And that was exactly how Carrie was. On March 15th, Carrie and her best friend Margie went shopping at their local mall. They picked out matching outfits and they were so excited to wear them to school together the next day. On March 16th, 1982, the girls showed up to school dressed alike. They had matching pants, matching shirts, and matching jackets. Later that day, Carrie and Margie met up in the lunchroom, and that is when Carrie told her friend that she had been suspended. Around the same time that Carrie and Margie were meeting up having this conversation, the school was calling Carrie's mother at home to inform her that Carrie had been suspended. Most reports say the suspension was for roaming the halls without a hall pass, essentially skipping class. Other sources claim that Carrie had gotten into a fight with a boy who threw paint on her brand new shirt. The exact reason for the suspension isn't especially important, but it's worth noting that there are some differing accounts. When the school called, they gave Carol two options. She could come and pick Carrie up, or the school would allow her to walk home. Since the school was only about a block or two away, literally it was like a 3-minute walk, Carol told them to let Carrie walk home and that she would be there waiting for her when she got there. But 1 o'clock came and went, then 2 o'clock, and Carrie never arrived. At first, Carol tried to reason it away. Maybe Carrie had stopped off at a friend's house on the way home. Maybe she was scared to come home after being suspended. But as the hours passed and there was still no sign of her daughter, worry began to creep in. Carol stood by the window watching the driveway, hoping and praying that she would see Carrie walk up towards the house. And while Carrie sometimes clashed with her stepfather and didn't always follow the rules, she always communicated with her mother. No matter how upset she got, she always let her mom know where she was going and when she would be home. And no matter what, she always came home. As the evening wore on and Carrie still hadn't returned, Carol's fear turned into panic. She finally called the police to report her daughter missing. They asked the standard questions, Carrie's age, her height, identifying details, but beyond taking the report, nothing was done. At the time, there was still a widely followed belief that you had to wait 24 hours before someone could officially be considered missing. After hanging up the phone, Carol went back to the window. She stayed there, watching, waiting, refusing to sleep, hoping that any moment her daughter would come walking up the driveway. But Carrie never did. The following day, March 17th, an official missing persons report was finally filed, and police began their investigation. They started by speaking with those closest to Carrie, her mother, her stepfather, and her younger sister. From there, investigators widened their scope, interviewing neighbors, classmates, and friends, hoping someone had seen or heard something that could explain where Carrie had gone. That's when they learned about a party that had taken place at the Mant residence, located directly across the street from Carrie's home. Robin Mant was a friend of Carrie's, and authorities discovered that Carrie had gone over to the house on the day she disappeared. But when police interviewed the people who attended this party, no one could offer up much details or any kind of helpful information, and many of them denied a party even happening. No one could say where Carrie went after the party, or even provide clear details about what happened while she was there. For Carol, the not knowing was unbearable. With every passing hour, her mind spiraled. Had someone taken Carrie while she was literally just across the street? A place that had always felt safe was now clouded with fear and grief. Carol couldn't just sit and wait. Waiting felt impossible. She needed to be doing something. With the help of her daughter Maggie, Carol began making flyers. Together, they went door to door to door, asking neighbors if they had seen Carrie. They posted flyers throughout town and spoke with anyone that was willing to listen. Carol also called everyone she knew, asking them to come and help search. And more than 30 people showed up to help however they could. Together, they walked the neighborhood streets, knocking on more doors, stopping strangers in their tracks, asking the same desperate question over and over again. Have you seen Carrie? But no one had. As the days passed, Carrie's absence became heavier and harder for the family to bear, especially her little sister Maggie. Every day after school, Maggie joined her mom in searching, sometimes staying out until after 10 o'clock at night. And eventually, Maggie broke down. She told her mother that she couldn't do it anymore. It was just too much to bear. While Carrie's family was sick with worry and fear, many people in the surrounding community weren't really alarmed. Some believed that Carrie had simply run away and that she would eventually come home on her own. In their minds, this historic Mitchell Street neighborhood was safe. It was a good place to raise a family and to have your children play outside until dark. A place where something truly sinister just wouldn't happen. At least, that's what they all believed. Carol leaned heavily on her faith to survive the days that followed. Every single day she prayed, asking God to bring her daughter home and begging for the strength to make it through another day without her. And just when it felt impossible to imagine life without Carrie, hope began to surface. reports of sightings started coming in. Some callers claimed that they had seen Carrie all the way in California. Others said they spotted her standing on a street corner or riding as a passenger in a person's car. Each call reignited hope, hope that Carrie was alive and that she was okay. Family and friends began to wonder if maybe Carrie had simply been too scared to come home after being suspended. Maybe she was hiding out at a friend's house, afraid of what would happen if she returned. Every time a tip came in, police followed up. Officers were dispatched to investigate each lead, but Carrie was never found. Weeks after her disappearance, Carol was out in public when she suddenly looked up and thought she saw her daughter. In a split second, her heart leapt. She began yelling Carrie's name, screaming it at the top of her lungs, unable to stop herself. The girl looked up and then ran. It wasn't Carrie. And I can't even begin to imagine what that moment must have felt like, to believe, even for a split second, that your missing child was right there in front of you, to feel that overwhelming rush of relief, that certainty that she was alive and coming home, only to watch her disappear, and to realize it wasn't your daughter after all. Heartbreaking doesn't even begin to cover it. Once again, the police responded to every single call and followed up on each reported sighting, but they all led nowhere. They interviewed anyone who might have information and pursued leads as they came in, doing everything they could with what they had. But weeks turned into months, and then the one-year anniversary of Carrie's disappearance arrived with still no sign of her. While Carol desperately wanted to believe her daughter was alive, the silence from Carrie was impossible to ignore. It was deafening. Deep down, she knew that something terrible had happened, because Carrie would have never stayed away this long by choice. Not without reaching out, not without coming home. And while the rest of the world kept moving forward, life for the Jopek family stood still. They were trapped in a never-ending nightmare. For 18 long months, the Jopek family lived with one unanswered question. Where was Carrie? And then on September 2nd, 1983, the truth was finally unearthed. On September 2nd, 1983, a contractor was working at the Mant residence, the house located directly across the street from Carrie's home. He had been hired to remove the back porch and level the soil underneath it. As he worked, his shovel struck something solid just a few inches below the surface. When he pulled the shovel back and looked down at the dirt he had displaced, he noticed something that immediately stopped him in his tracks. What appeared to be human hair. The contractor dropped to his knees and began carefully digging with his hands. That's when he uncovered the fully intact body of a female hidden beneath the porch. Shaken and horrified, the contractor immediately called police. Officers arrived within minutes, and soon several squad cars surrounded the Mant residence as investigators began processing the scene. It didn't take long for Carrie's family to notice the sudden commotion unfolding right across the street. Carol walked over to the Mant home and saw Carrie's friend Robin Mant and asked her what was going on. Robin told her that remains had been found under the deck. Carol then asked one devastating question. What was the body wearing? And Robin described the clothing. It was exactly what Carrie had been last seen wearing the day she disappeared. Standing there in the front yard of the Mant residence, Carol knew in her heart what that meant. The realization hit her all at once, and it was crushing. She tried to move closer to the scene, but officers held her back. In shock and disbelief, Carol broke down, attempting to push past them. Robin then told police that Carol believed the remains belonged to her daughter, who had been missing for nearly 18 months. Once officers were able to calm her, they told Carol to return home and assured her that they would be in contact. Back at the scene, investigators continued their work, uncovering a body that had been placed in a shallow grave about 5 inches deep. The body was partially decomposed, and once it was carefully removed, it was transported to the coroner's office for examination. What makes this discovery even more heartbreaking is what Carol watched from her home. She stood at the front window and watched as everything unfolded across the street. And even though there was no official confirmation yet, no name attached to the remains, she knew. She knew in her heart. And it's devastating to think that Carrie had been right there the entire time, across the street, waiting to be found. The following morning, as the sun rose, word spread quickly throughout the neighborhood that a body had been discovered at the Mant residence. Local news stations picked up the story almost immediately, and by sunup, it was splashed across the front page of the newspaper. The article included details about the clothing the body had been wearing. When Carrie's friend Margie saw the paper, she knew instantly. She recognized that outfit. It was the same matching outfit the two girls had bought together, meant to be worn together to school. And in that moment, any lingering hope was gone. 4 days after the remains were discovered, it became official. Carol received the phone call confirming that the body had been positively identified as Carrie Ann Jopek through dental records. After the identification, Carol was allowed to go to the coroner's office to view the personal items Carrie had been wearing when she died. Her shoes, her pants, and her jacket, all of it was there. For Carol, it was an unimaginable painful moment. The grief was crushing, but alongside that grief, she felt something else. She felt relief. Relief that she no longer had to search for her daughter. Relief knowing that Carrie was no longer lost, no longer alone, and was now resting in God's hands. While Carrie's family began the painful process of mourning, detectives were focused on uncovering exactly what had happened to her. During the autopsy, the medical examiner found that Carrie's C1 vertebrae, the bone at the top of the spine, had been partially fractured. The injury was described as similar to a severe whiplash type injury. Carrie also had a fracture on the left side of her skull. Investigators determined that the injury could have occurred accidentally from a fall, or it could have been the result of someone intentionally striking her. What was clear, however, was this. Carrie didn't bury herself. Someone placed her body beneath that porch and managed to get away with it for 18 months. What's especially frustrating is that despite these findings, the medical examiner did not immediately rule Carrie's death as a homicide. Instead, the manner of death was classified as undetermined. Now, let's back up just for a moment and talk about the Mant family. Carrie's friend Robin lived in the home with her parents and her older brother, John Mant. John was a few years older than both Carrie and Robin. Authorities quickly learned that John had a reputation for being a troublemaker. He had a history of petty theft, frequently caused problems, and was known to drink alcohol and smoke marijuana. The Mant residence was also known in the neighborhood for hosting frequent parties, involving underage drinking and drug use. The people who attended ranged from middle and high school students to young adults who had recently graduated. Often, these parties took place during the day and became a place kids could go when they wanted to skip school. And that's exactly where Carrie went after she had been suspended. Given John's reputation and the fact that Carrie's body was found buried in their backyard, many people immediately suspected him. Things became even more troubling when investigators learned what happened the moment the body was discovered. When the contractor uncovered the remains, he looked over his shoulder in complete shock and saw John Mant standing nearby, watching. According to reports, John immediately began to panic. He ran inside the house and started vomiting. He actually became so violently ill that investigators were unable to interview him that night, and that reaction stood out. Now, sure, anyone would be shaken up by something like that. Finding out that a body was buried in your backyard isn't exactly an everyday experience. But for many, including the investigators, it raised red flags that he was freaking out. Was John overwhelmed by fear, by panic, by the realization that he had been caught? As detectives dug deeper, they uncovered yet another disturbing detail. John Mant had allegedly made sexual advances towards Carrie on more than one occasion. And let me remind you, Carrie was just 13 years old. John was reportedly 18 or 19 at the time. Suddenly, all eyes were on him. It seemed like the most plausible explanation. Carrie was last seen at his house. Her body was buried in his backyard. Had she rejected him again? Had something escalated? Had he snapped? Even Carol believed John may have been involved. 3 days after Carrie's remains were discovered, detectives brought John in for questioning. He told authorities that he knew Carrie from the neighborhood, but that she was friends with his younger sister. But when asked if he had anything to do with her death, he denied it. Detectives questioned him about the party that took place at his house on the day that Carrie disappeared, and John denied that as well. Despite multiple people coming forward and confirming that this party had happened, investigators pressed him about his reaction when the body was discovered, and John claimed that he became sick simply because he was in shock. When asked how the body ended up buried under his porch, he said he had no idea. As detectives continued to push, John stopped answering questions and asked for a lawyer. Unfortunately, despite their efforts, authorities were unable to find any solid evidence tying John Mant to Carrie's death. 1 week after her remains were discovered, Carrie was finally laid to rest. At her funeral, Carrie's friends, including Robin and Margie, clung to one another, sobbing as they said their final goodbyes. Carol later described the service as overwhelming, filled with conflicting emotions. There was deep pain, sadness and grief, of course, but also a sense of peace in believing that Carrie was now in heaven. In the days and months after the funeral, many of Carrie's friends continued to stop by the family home to spend time with Carol. It brought Carol comfort being surrounded by people who loved her daughter. Robin and Margie visited often, as did another neighborhood teen named Jose Ferreira. Jose lived just down the road from both Carrie and the Mants. He frequently stopped by to visit Carol, sometimes sitting with her and playing cards while they reminisced about Carrie. But one evening, Jose made a comment that immediately unsettled Carol. He told her that Carrie was haunting him. The words sent a chill through her. Why would he say that? Why would he feel haunted by her daughter? The only explanation Carol could come up with was that maybe, just maybe, Jose had played a role in Carrie's death, and the guilt was beginning to surface. Not long after the funeral, investigators received another troubling phone call, this time about Jose. A neighbor of the Mant family reported seeing Jose in the backyard near where Carrie had been buried. According to the caller, Jose was on his hands and knees in the dirt, right where Carrie's body had been found. He appeared to be sifting through the soil with his hands, talking to himself. At times, he would raise his hands towards the sky, mumbling something that nobody could hear. This was deeply unsettling and honestly kind of disturbing. To be sifting through the dirt where his friend had been buried. She had partially decomposed there. That's just kind of freaking weird if you ask me. Investigators also learned that Jose was known to practice witchcraft, which only fueled the rumors already circulating through the neighborhood. Speculation spread quickly. Some believed Jose was involved in Carrie's death. Others thought he knew exactly who was responsible and that the guilt was slowly consuming him. Jose was already known to Milwaukee police due to prior theft-related incidents, so investigators brought him in for questioning. During the interview, Jose appeared calm. He didn't seem rattled or defensive and maintained his composure throughout the entire time speaking to the detectives. When asked why he had been in the Mant backyard, Jose explained that he was thinking about Carrie and mourning her death. He said that while he was there, essentially paying his respects, he became overwhelmed and began to cry. Jose told investigators that he had been struggling deeply with Carrie's death and was feeling depressed and down about it. To make matters worse, his girlfriend had recently broken up with him, so everything was piling up and he was just having a hard time handling it. He admitted that at one point, he did raise his hands to the sky and asked God why Carrie had to be taken, why it had to be her of all people. During questioning, detectives also learned that Jose was likely one of the last people to see Carrie alive. He had been at the Mant residence during the party Carrie attended on the day she disappeared. Still, Jose insisted he had nothing to do with her disappearance or death. He claimed that after the party, he didn't know where Carrie went. And just like with John Mant, there was no physical evidence tying Jose to Carrie's murder. Police had no choice but to let him go. At this point, investigators had hit a wall. The case had stalled, and frustration set in for everyone involved. The Milwaukee Police Department desperately wanted to solve Carrie's case. They wanted answers, they wanted accountability, and more than anything, they wanted to give Carol and the rest of the family some sense of closure, whatever closure was still possible. But with no new leads and no witnesses willing to come forward, the case slowly went cold. Year after year passed with no answers. And that silence weighed heavily on many hearts, especially Carrie's best friend, Margie. In an interview on the show Buried in the Backyard, Margie shared her greatest regret, not leaving school with Carrie the day that she was suspended. She said that if she had walked out with her, they never would have gone to the party at the Mant House. Margie carried that guilt for a very long time. And I want to say this clearly. She had absolutely nothing to feel guilty about. She was just a kid. She couldn't have known what was going to happen. It was not her fault that she stayed at school where she should have been. Carol also carried her own guilt for years, wishing she had gone to pick up Carrie instead of letting her walk home. And it truly breaks my heart that both Carol and Margie shouldered that weight for so long. Hindsight is always 20/20, but what happened to Carrie was not their fault, not then, not now, and my heart goes out to them. After 6 long, agonizing years with no updates and no real movement in the case, investigators finally received a call on October 19, 1989. An inmate at Dodge Correctional Institution had reached out claiming he had information about the death of Carrie Jopek. For detectives who had worked this case for years, the call brought a renewed sense of urgency and hope. When a case has been silent for that long, any new lead feels monumental. Word spread quickly that someone was talking. Interest in the case reignited, and once again, there was hope that Carrie might finally get justice, and that her family might get some long overdue answers. The inmate was identified as Thomas Luker. Thomas told investigators that he was a former boyfriend of Robin Mant and that the two had dated between 1983 and 1986. According to Thomas, during their relationship, Robin had confided in him that her brother John was responsible for Carrie's death. Thomas claimed Robin told him that after Carrie was killed, her body was kept in the Mant family's basement for 2 to 3 days before being buried in the backyard. Given the seriousness of the accusation, investigators immediately followed up and re-interviewed Robin Mant. Robin confirmed that she had dated Thomas and acknowledged that they had talked about Carrie's death and the discovery of her body in her backyard, but she firmly denied ever telling him anything like what he was claiming. Robin told investigators she believed Thomas was lying, making up the story out of anger and resentment after their breakup. She maintained that she had no knowledge of how Carrie died and stated clearly that she did not believe her brother had any involvement. Investigators attempted to corroborate Thomas's claims, but once again, there was no evidence. Nothing to support his story, nothing to connect John Mant to Carrie's death. And just like that, the hope that had briefly resurfaced was crushed. The lead went nowhere, and Carrie Jopek's case went cold once again. As time went on, many people in the community began to accept a painful reality: that Carrie's case might never be solved and that her family might never get the answers they deserved. But for investigators, this was personal. They refused to let it go. And while detectives held on to hope, so did Carrie's family and friends. They believed that someday, somehow, the truth would come out, because what is done in dark always comes to light. That belief is what carried them through the next 25 years. Then on a Sunday morning in October 2015, everything changed. A local television producer named Will Myers received a phone call that would alter the course of the case forever. The man on the other end of the line told him he wanted to confess to a murder. Immediately, Will knew that this wasn't an ordinary call. He was no stranger to strange tips or odd messages at the station, but this felt different. The caller began talking about his personal life, sharing details about the time that he spent in jail. Will listened closely, writing everything down. Then the man finally said it. He claimed that in 1982, he had been with Carrie Jopek and that he buried her under the porch in the backyard of the Mant residence. He said that ever since that day, Carrie had haunted him, that the guilt had eaten away at him for decades ever since he was a teenager. After ending the call, Will immediately contacted his manager, and together they called police. That's when they learned something chilling. The man's estranged wife had also contacted the authorities. He had confessed to her as well. He had even called a crisis hotline telling them the same thing. This man was Jose Ferreira. At first, there was skepticism. Why would someone confess to a murder by calling a news station, of all places? It just seemed random and almost unbelievable. But investigators followed the lead, and this time it was real. When police contacted Jose and asked him to come in for an interview, he agreed without hesitation. When detectives entered the room, Jose was polite and respectful, but he was visibly weighed down by what he had been carrying for more than 3 decades. Jose confessed. He told investigators that he had gone to a party at John Mant's house, the same party Carrie attended after being suspended from school. According to Jose, several kids who had skipped school were there also, and the party involved alcohol and marijuana. Jose said that while inside the house, he noticed Carrie standing near a doorway that led to the basement. He claimed that she asked him for a cigarette. When he said he didn't have one, he offered her marijuana instead, which she accepted. They smoked together and talked, and at some point, Jose said Carrie asked if he wanted to go down into the basement, a space known among the teens as a place where kids would go down and make out. He assumed that that was what was going to happen. But as they started down the stairs, Carrie changed her mind. She told him that maybe this just wasn't a good idea after all. That's when Jose became angry. He told her that they were going downstairs, and then he violently shoved her. Carrie fell down the stairs and struck her head on the way down. Jose said he believed that she had just been knocked unconscious, and according to later reporting, he admitted to sexually assaulting her before realizing that she was dead. After a few minutes, he tried to lift her, and that's when he knew. Her head had twisted unnaturally when he picked her up, and he realized that her neck was broken. Panicked and terrified, Jose said he didn't know what to do, so he dragged Carrie's body into the backyard, dug a shallow grave beneath the porch, and buried her. He told investigators it took about 45 minutes. And what's almost impossible to comprehend is that all of this happened while a house full of people were partying just upstairs. No one noticed, no one asked where Carrie went. From that night on, Jose said he lived with crushing guilt and remorse. When asked if anyone else was involved, he said that he acted alone. Jose Ferreira was arrested and charged with second-degree murder. After 33 agonizing years, investigators were finally able to go to Carol and tell her they had identified the person responsible for her daughter's death. The news shattered her. Jose wasn't a stranger. He was someone that had been in their lives for years, someone who had spent time at their home after Carrie's death. To learn that he was responsible was an unimaginable betrayal. And I do have to say, Carol had that little feeling back when he said that Carrie had haunted her, but with no findings that he was involved, she wanted to believe that he was innocent, and so, in her mind, all those years he was. Jose's trial was scheduled for January 2017, but on the day it was set to begin, he accepted a plea deal. He pleaded guilty to attempted second-degree sexual assault by use of force and false imprisonment. He was sentenced to just 7 years in prison. The sentence came 35 years and 1 day after Carrie first went missing. Many were outraged by how light the sentence was, and understandably so. But prosecutors feared that taking the case to trial could result in an acquittal due to the lack of physical evidence despite the confession. They wanted to ensure that Jose served some time. And perhaps most surprisingly, Carol supported the plea deal. In interviews, she admitted she felt sympathy for Jose. She believed that he had been suffering too, that guilt and remorse had haunted him for decades, just as he claimed. The plea deal spared the family from reliving the trauma during a long trial, and to Carol, 7 years was better than nothing. At sentencing, Jose addressed the family saying, quote, "I can't take back how it happened. Sorry. From the deepest pain in my heart, sorry," end quote. As of 2022, Jose Ferreira has been released from prison. He is living in Glendale, Wisconsin, registered as a sex offender and under active community supervision. I hope that wherever he is today, he is still confronted by the weight of what he did. Carol's strength in accepting this sentence is something I deeply admire. The grace shown by victims' families in moments like this is something I don't think I'll ever fully understand, but I will always respect. I hope that everyone who knew and loved Carrie has found at least some sense of peace. Carrie Jopek was just 13 years old. She had her entire life left ahead of her, and it's absolutely tragic that her life was stolen simply because she said no. You guys, that is all that I have for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening. Make sure you're in my private Facebook group by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. If you haven't already hit the subscribe button on your preferred podcast platform, make sure you do so that you are notified every single time that a new episode goes live. And if you're feeling up to it, please leave a review, preferably a 5-star review. Wink, wink, just kidding, kind of. Leaving a review not only lets me know that you guys are loving the content that I am creating and that I'm putting out there, but it also helps the podcast grow by suggesting it to listeners like you. If you want to keep up with what I've got going on in life, follow me on Instagram at CrimeAHolly. The family and I are headed out this afternoon for a little weekend getaway, so make sure you follow me to see where we are headed and what we are doing. Lastly, if you would like more true crime content, follow me on TikTok at crimewithholly.podcast. All right, guys, that is all that I've got for you. You know what to do. Always remember to be aware and take care. Bye-bye.